This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5. And Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. Now, as we embark on over 18 months of genocide in the Gaza Strip at the hands of the Israeli regime, we ask just how much more? When does the last child or mother have to perish in this onslaught? What happened to the January 19 ceasefire, which was to be a blueprint to end this barbaric campaign against the Palestinian people? Not only did the Israeli occupation tear up that ceasefire and resume attacking Gaza, it coupled it with a 100% blockade on all humanitarian aid into the Strip, and is now dramatically to expand its ground invasion into the besieged territory. Plan has been condemned by Palestinian resistance factions, the UK, China, the United Nations, the European Union, and many other voices who want an immediate end to the misery and suffering of Gazans, not an extension, not an escalation, and not an expansion of the occupation's military aggression. This is a focus of today's Spotlight program. But first, let's start with this report.
Conquest of Gaza. That's the objective Israel has announced for a newly approved plan aimed at expanding its genocidal war against Gaza. A blueprint that signals a new wave of death and destruction for over 2.1 million Palestinians trapped in one of the most densely populated territories in the world. Months of bombardment, thousands dead, families torn apart. None of these seem to have quenched Israel's thirst for blood. Despite global outrage and deepening humanitarian catastrophe and the fully blockaded Gaza Strip, the regime has unveiled a plan to intensify its onslaught against the already devastated territory. The overnight approved plan includes, among other things, Israel's escalated onslaught against all areas of the Gaza Strip, the capture of this strip and holding the territories, forcibly moving the Gaza population south and denying Hamas the ability to distribute humanitarian supplies. The plan has sparked sharp reactions both domestically and globally. Inside Israel, many see the move as an admission by the regime that it is exchanging land for the lives of the captives held in Gaza, accusing Netanyahu of prioritizing his own political interests over the will of the majority of Israelis. Internationally, the plan has drawn significant condemnation, including from some of Israel's Western allies. France has labeled the plan as unacceptable and a violation of humanitarian law, while the European Union has warned it would exacerbate suffering among Palestinians, leaving large swathes of the devastated Strip without access to life-saving supplies. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has raised the alarm over the Israeli plan, warning it'll inevitably cause more deaths and destruction.
The Israeli plan will inevitably lead to countless more civilians killed and the further destruction of Gaza. Gaza is and will remain an integral part of a future Palestinian state.
Rights and humanitarian groups also say the measure is part of the regime's genocidal campaign to reinforce control over life-sustaining supplies, describing it as a war crime and collective punishment.
They're clearly a war crime, allowing a boycott of food and humanitarian aid to a population under your control is collective punishment and it's a war crime.
In the United States, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib has denounced U.S. support for Israel, describing Washington as accomplice in the genocide in Gaza. Just months ago, U.S. President Donald Trump made headlines with a stunning announcement, a plan for the United States to take control of the Gaza Strip and forcibly relocate its population. Trump, however, had to back down on his proposal due to worldwide condemnations, as Israel now moves forward with a strategy many say echoes Trump's. Critics are asking, is Washington enabling Tel Aviv to realize what Trump could not?
And now for our guests. Joining us in the program is Professor Saad Nimr, Professor of Political Science, joining us out of Birzeit University in occupied Ramallah. Emissar Saeb Shat, author and commentator, joining us from Belfast. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. Great to have you both on. Professor Nimr, we're going to start with you there in Ramallah. Your initial thoughts, sir, why today we are discussing a military expansion by the Zionist entity into Gaza, calling up tens of thousands of reservists. There was a high time, January 19th, to put an end to this thing. Why was that not the more attractive option? And why are we looking at an and with this expansion is going to come possibly Israel losing its captives and more occupation forces there at the hands of the resistance in Gaza. Your initial thoughts, please.
I think that this plan by the Israelis is a devious one. The idea is that they want to deliver the aid through the area between the two corridors. One is Morag, the one which was created lately, and the other one is Philadelphia. So in this area of Rafah, they wanted to bring all the people into Gaza. And if they want food and if they want water and aid, they have to come by families, and the head of the family should take this kind of help and aid, and then they will stay in this area, which is approximate on the approximate borders with Egypt in Rafah. And it means that they are also deciding which family will have or wouldn't have food and to go into this area. So it's a safe, kind of safe, as they call it, area, haven area, where food is available, water is available, and medical aid is available. So families should come and apply, and after they check them, they enter them into this zone. That is the plan by Israel to deliver the food and the humanitarian aid, and it will be done by an American company. Now, this is preparation for the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. Those people who are near to the borders, next time they will close and they say, no food, no food for you, you can't go anywhere, and they open the gates of Rafah crossing and say, okay, go to Egypt. So they will push them out. That's the plan. So it's quite clear that this plan is rejected not only by the Palestinians, but also by the international community and the international also organizations, including the United Nations in the speech of Guterres. So it is quite clear that the aim of this plan by Israel is not to give or to deliver the humanitarian aid to the Palestinians, as they claim, but rather to gather all the Palestinians in this sector, and after that, they will push them out all together.
Thank you, Professor. Mr. Saeb Shat, welcome to the program, and thank you for your patience. Mr. Shat, how much do you feel, sir, that Donald Trump's threats to dispossess Palestinians of Gaza, he made that threat a few times, you very well know, since assuming his second term in office, he kind of backstepped on it, backpedaled to some degree, see what kind of damage his rhetoric was leading to. But nevertheless, it seems the leadership in Tel Aviv, it has started changing its policy, behaving completely differently, both in rhetoric and in action, since Donald Trump mentioned, relocating permanently all of Gazans and turning it into a hotel community, beachside hotel real estate?
Yeah, it's a good question. Since the Trump arrival and the Trump idea, which is a satanic idea of a cleansing Gaza of its population and turn it to the Middle East Riviera for the rich and wealthy and filthy as well to live and have fun on top of the skulls of the martyrs of Gaza, forgetting what is Gaza of a 7,000 years history, while his own United States of America doesn't have 250 years of history under its belt. Gaza called the Ghazat Hashim, which is the Gaza of Hashim. Hashim is the grandfather of Prophet Muhammad. It's holy to the Muslims. Gaza's been mentioned in the Quran, in the Rihlat al-Sayfi wa-Shita, the trip of winter and summer in the Quran. So Gaza in its own, with its huge history, even prior to Islam, from Alexander the Great, from the Egyptian Hyksos and the Hyksos invasion of Egypt, Gaza is a huge history. There, it's cannot the city and the strip who defeated Alexander the Great, who defeated Napoleon Bonaparte, will be able as well, who defeated it twice, the British Empire, will be able to inflict a major scale defeat on the Zionist Entity Army. Now the Zionist Entity Army to implement the satanic idea of Netanyahu, since they have now the backing of the United States of America, nobody will touch them as long as Trump and they're behind. They want to beef their army with thousands of reservists who some of these people already done 300 to 400 days of reserves duty since October the 7th. And now today, the Zionist entity, we can see the reserves duty call up rates are very low indeed. It's the lowest in the history of the entity. They're supposed to go deep into Gaza to start, as my colleague mentioned, evacuating completely the Palestinian people and to push them near the an area which is, they call it the Zionist Entity Security Zone, which is between Murad and the Philadelphia. Some of the underground of Gaza, that's an area used to be a settlement in there called Murad, not Murag. The Hebrew, they'll try to call it Murag with a biblical kind of twist. The Zionist army plan is actually to reoccupy, as Smotrich said, there is shouldn't be afraid to use the word occupation. And he said the operation goal is to occupy and conquer the Gaza Strip. And in that, the occupation will bring back the history which is they lived through in Gaza Strip before in the year 2004 and before that. And once they faced the resistance in Gaza in 2005 under their kind of legend, Sharon, the general who is the most decorated general in the history of the Zionist entity, who was their prime minister, they went on the run from the Gaza Strip. They took the resettlements and their settlers and their army and went on the run. And they were at the time deployed only to protect their settlements. Today, if you want to go deep in Gaza, it means you are at war with the incubators of the resistance, which is the Palestinian population. You want to cleanse them or you want to shove them to Rafah. You are at war with all the population in the Gaza Strip. Then you'll need hundreds of thousands of troops. You'll need over 7 divisions of army to achieve just the pushing toward the Rafah corridor, without even alluding to the satanic idea of controlling the aid, which mean they want to try to buy a lot of converting people against their own resistance by blackmail them with the aid or with arresting them in these corridors and safe. So the whole idea it's amazing. Humanity watching that, humanity watching in action, a Nazi concentration camp in creation.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Professor, Mr. Saib Shath. Professor Nimr, I got thrown off because I just saw this thing come in, this quote by this young man, Mohammed Al-Kafarna, there in Jabalia, northern Gaza. He said, "We are deeply concerned about the talk of full-scale invasion of the Gaza Strip," says Mohammed Al-Kafarna, "amid destroyed buildings in Jabalia camp as the Israeli military prepares for a broader assault." He said, "Pressuring us now serves absolutely no purpose." This is a resident of Jabalia saying, because there is nothing left. Now, Professor Nimr, I'd also like to get you to elaborate more on Donald Trump's Gaza annexation, permanent annexation plan. How much do you see his threats impacting Zionist moves to speed up with this expansion, calling up all these reservists, the ethnic cleansing of Gaza, and for what purpose?
Okay, let's start with the first part of your question. When we are talking about the full-scale invasion of the Israeli army to Gaza Strip, as they declare all the time, they have many problems so far. First of all, there are three divisions now around Gaza or in Gaza on the borders. And they said that if they need to go for a full invasion of Gaza and land invasion, they need at least six divisions. Now they need to recruit these three additional divisions. And as your guest also from Belfast said, they are facing now a huge problem with the reserves that they refuse. And the number reached to around over 50% of the reserves, they refuse to join back the army to go into Gaza. This is on the one hand, and it's not me, even the opposition in Israel, they are saying, what is the point of going into Gaza? In addition to killing the prisoners, the Israeli prisoners captive by the Palestinian resistance, there is no other, you know, target that you can achieve in going in. So by that, they wanted to clear. And apparently, the Israelis going, the other problem that they are going to face is the resistance. The resistance is still there, and they are still in their power, and they are going, you know, they are waiting for the Israeli army, as a matter of fact, to go in to Gaza. And in the last 2 weeks, we have witnessed what was going on in some areas which was declared by the Israeli as burned totally by bombardments and by airplanes and by airstrikes and artillery, and they burned it totally, burned land. And yet the resistance came out from nowhere. They came out from these tunnels that they have. So it's not an easy task, and that will cause the Israeli a lot of problems inside Israel itself. This is on the one hand. Now, on the other part of the question regarding what Trump wanted, as you mentioned before, you know, Trump wanted to clear Gaza from his point of view. That was the initial. But I think now he realized, and the American realized, and everyone realized that this is not going to happen. Neither by the Israeli nor by the Americans or anyone else. No one is agreeing to this kind of action by the Americans. And the idea is so stupid, to ethnically cleanse the whole population of Gaza in order to build some areas on near to the shore and to the sea and have some hotels there. This is absolutely a kind of a stupid idea. So and the Palestinians in Gaza are not going to leave. Even if they were pushed out, they are not going to leave, and they won't leave even after the gates few meters. It's because they are attached that much to their land, and they are not going to leave. Plus, they are, you know, forgetting totally about the Palestinian resistance, as if they are acting as if the Palestinian resistance is not there. But it's not happening. That the same strategy or the same ideas they have used in Lebanon. They are now acting in Lebanon as if the Lebanese resistance is not acting and Hezbollah is not there anymore. Well, yeah, we know that they are committed to the agreement of ceasefire, but it doesn't mean that it's vanished. It might come back again. And the same with the Palestinian resistance. It is not finished. It's still there. And the Israeli report saying that they are even now, they recruited more and more people, and they are now ready even before, much better than before. So I think that the Israeli plan, whether it was the humanitarian aid or the invasion, it will face lots of problems and it will fail.
And you alluded to this earlier, Mr. Saeb Shaath, that what many people possibly do not see or account for is that the resistance and the Palestinians fighting in Gaza, they're fighting for survival, existence, life. They're not fighting to steal, to occupy, to ethnically cleanse. There are two completely different ideologies and wars being waged and fought here, aren't there? And how does that equate to the conflict as we see it on the ground? And to your point also, once Palestinians in Gaza, if they get the wind that Tel Aviv is actually going to really try to push Donald Trump's plan through, you're going to see a 2 million person resistance as opposed to whatever they're saying now, 20 or 30,000 member resistance.
You see, Trump wants the Zionist entity to achieve that without any blood spilled from the Americans, Marines, or from American Special Forces. We know there is on Gaza, on the ground of Gaza, Delta Force, which is an American specialist task force in there. And it lost seven of its own soldiers during the failed operation of rescuing some of the prisoners last year. The same, they are in there supporting and giving coordinates and training the Zionist entity into tactics which they deployed and used in many areas in Afghanistan or in Iraq and that in counterinsurgency. So the Americans want to see the Zionist entity impose the military will over Gaza Strip. And to deploy that plans, it means it's need to accelerate the genocide and the ethnic cleansing of Gaza Strip under the cover of pushing them toward security areas or safe zone, if you want to call it. But as I mentioned, the whole idea is you want to get rid of the Gaza resistance to cleanse, to take the land. It means the Gaza resistance is the people of Gaza. As you mentioned, the 2 million of people of the Gazans, it's the incubator, the people fighting for their life, fighting for their land. This incubation satanic state landed on them with the British Empire occupying Palestine at the end of 1917, early 1918, the deploying all of the genocidal kind of experiments the British done in Ireland and somewhere else and deployed it in Palestine. So the Americans inherited that, and the Americans now have a strong military base they believe in, and they wanted to gain its deterrence, which was lost in front of the Palestinians and Lebanese and Yemenis today, resistance, and as well was smashed by the promised response from Iran 1 and 2. So to do that, they're trying now to destroy the Gaza Strip. And who is acting involved in that? the United States of America, the British, the French, the Germans, with supporting and beefing up the Zionist entity with the latest technologies and state-of-art technologies, with from artificial intelligence to the stupid bombs, as they say, to counter the Palestinian resistance. But as you said yourself, they're going to face 2 million people who are dearly loving their land.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for joining us on the program. Professor Saad Nimr joining us from Occupied Ramallah, and Mr. Saib Shah joining us from Belfast. This brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thanks for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. Welcome to another enlightening episode of Islamic Upbringing, where we dive deep into the essential aspects of nurturing your youth in line with Islamic teachings. In this program, our discussions are rooted in the guidance of the Holy Quran and the timeless wisdom of Hadith from our beloved Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, and the insightful narratives of our noble Imams. I'm glad to have with us today Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas, a research scholar from the Seminary of Qom, who possesses a wealth of knowledge in both Islamic studies as well as psychology. So, Brother Liaqat Abbas, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
So, we have been talking about the strategies that parents and educators can imply to help the teenagers to navigate different sorts of challenges. Brother, you know, previously you told us that there are some strategies that are specific to parents, there are some strategies that are specific to educators. We discussed the strategies that parents can apply, basically. So I would want you to go ahead with the strategies of the educators to help the teenagers navigate certain issues.
Okay. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There are a few things which are common for the parents and the educators. But as the first thing, which is exclusively for the educators, is creating an inclusive environment, like having an environment where all the students feel accepted and valued, is very important.
Okay. Or,
like giving value
no
to
favoritism.
Each. No, definitely. Yeah, of course. Even if the person has it, he's not going to show it in front of the class. He's not going to say, oh, you know what, this person is the best.
Yeah.
All of you, the rest are waste, example, or useless, yeah, or hopeless. You're yeah, not gonna, you see? So being valued is very important, okay?
So sometimes, like, teacher thinks that they are appreciating one student, but they have to, even if they want to appreciate, they have to appreciate in a way the others do not feel disheartened.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Or example, if you want to correct someone, correct in a way the educator or the teacher, example, should correct in a way that the person shouldn't get hurt. Like he or she should accept it in a positive manner, okay? So this is one way, like when a kind of environment is created,
yeah,
where everyone is valued, where
yeah,
everyone is respected, I would say, then the challenges are easier to navigate. Example.
Yes.
The second thing is, of course, open dialogue, encouraging open dialogue, which will give the students, the teens example over here in our example, it will give them space to discuss their challenge, to share their experience.
Yeah.
When there's an open dialogue in the class example,
yeah,
me, example, if I'm a teen, okay, I'm going to share my experience. My friend is going to share his experience. My other classmate is going to share his experience. And all together, like, we can have a solution upon a particular challenge, okay? Example, how to overcome the haram stuff, example, okay?
Yeah.
Which is portrayed in today's world, okay?
Yes.
Example, how to overcome alcoholism, example, okay?
Yeah.
So I'm going to give a strategy. My friend is going to give a strategy. My classmates are going to give their strategies. So in this manner, so this open dialogue system is very important to be held in the classes, I would say, for
okay.
the educators. It shouldn't be only from the educator. The educator should also listen to the teens or to the students.
Yeah.
And this open dialogue should happen when he or she is conducting classes.
Yes.
The third, I would say, which is very important, is recognizing the signs of distress as an educator.
Okay.
Educator should have this quality. The educator should recognize if there's the amount of anxiety levels, the amount of distress, the amount of depression, example, if any teen is facing, example,
yeah.
okay?
Recognize it.
Recognize it, yeah. This should be there in the educator, in the teacher. Why? Because, example,
let's explore further on that note after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned. Don't go anywhere.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman. Don't give in to Shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsinin, Wa Khaliquna, Wa Rasiquna, Wa Huwa Ala Kulli Shay'in Qadir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Liaquat Abbas is here, and we are discussing certain strategies that educators can apply to help teenagers navigate certain sorts of challenges. You said a different. You told us some of the strategies, and you were explaining one of them. So I want you to continue.
Okay. So I was saying recognizing the signs of distress and anxiety. You know, when a teen has anxiety, okay, and like about a particular thing. Example, whenever a question is asked to the teen, he gets anxiety, okay? He gets anxious about it. He gets distressed about it, example. So over here, it's very important that you don't point out, you don't point to that teen to stand up and tell the answer or explain it.
All right.
Because the anxiety, the levels are going to increase in the teen, okay? The teen might face a kind of shamefulness because he's unable to explain it to the class, okay?
Yeah.
If you find the anxiety levels increasing or depression levels increasing, distress increasing, then let it go. It's okay. And you can privately address the issue with the teen, example, okay? Because now there is a challenge being faced by the teen. His anxiety is a lot, okay? This is a challenge. You as an educator, you can't pull the teen onto the stage. Example, me as an educator. Okay?
Yeah, so I will add something here. Mm-hmm. I'm an educator. I'm teaching somewhere, and I do face whatever you're saying right now. I really actually can feel it. And, you know, I have a student, she got very less marks in her written paper. And then the administration told me, we don't want her report card to get read. Could you just retake the exam? Yes, we know she's very weak. She's anxious and all. But try to retake exam because, like, we just want this report card to be green so that she does not feel further anxious in future.
Mm-hmm.
So I just happened to talk to this child first, and I told her, like, you wrote very well, but why did you stop writing? And then she told me, because she forgot.
Mm-hmm.
I told her, okay, if you forget things, just imagine I'm someone and I don't know this thing. How do you tell this thing to me? And she explained in a way unimaginable. Mm-hmm. And that I happened to give her full marks later because, like, I took an oral test and I told her, see, when you explain things, you explain in a much better way. You explain even I was content with your explanation. So I was kind of trying to, you know, boost her confidence. Mm-hmm. So some people, if you feel like, I think the school expected me to take a written test again, but I felt I should go with oral one.
Yep.
Because I know if I'm going to take written again, the result is going to be same. So I would see where the problem is actually.
Yeah.
So the girl was anxious, basically writing the answer. So I just told her, okay, I'm sitting here. Mm-hmm. I'm a student. You explain things for me, mm-hmm. but in a very playful way. And she was amazing. Able to, you know.
Amazing.
So yeah, like if you as an educator are able to recognize and then apply the strategies
yes.
in different way to reduce that anxiety, it really works. I just added that out of experience. Excellent. We'll discuss more with you, brother. Let's take a short break here and we'll be back in a while.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, a righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing and Brother Liaquat is here with me in the studio. We were talking about some of the strategies that, you know, educators can apply to help teenagers navigate through certain challenges. Mm-hmm. Brother said that recognize as an educator the points of despair, the times when they feel anxious and try to help them navigate the situation. Yeah.
Yep. So just like you have said about the marks and the numbering system, unfortunately, many, many teens face this, yeah, the mm-hmm. anxiety levels. Just like we have discussed it even in the previous yeah. episodes, yeah, about how they are concerned about their marks and if they get less marks, what would be told to them by their parents, about what will be told to them by their teachers, example, how will the school look at them or the university look at them, yeah? How will the society look at them? These are all like the stress parts of a teen, example. Anyways, so over here, it's very important for the educator, like, and unfortunately about the mark system, I would say like the oral test example, which you have taken, I would say was really amazing. Where you see the potential of your student over here. And of course, the anxiety of writing the exam is not there for your student, isn't it? So that anxiety, you have removed it. You see the challenge. But you know what? Over here, like everywhere, in every single place, the anxiety remains or reduces for a while and might hit in the same place, in the same situation, when the person is kept again in the same situation in the future life. So over there, it's very important to help the child navigate through anxiety by giving him or her different strategies. And over here, another strategy which comes and plays a very important role is to engage parents. The educator should engage the parents of this particular child.
I remember the head of our institution said in a parent-teacher meeting that we are a triangle. One corner of this triangle is the students themselves, one corner is the parents, and one corner is the teachers, educators. Mm-hmm. These do not get separated. They go along, and yeah, they do go along. So while engaging parents...
Yeah. So yeah. When you're engaging parents, communicate regularly with them, with the yeah. parents.
Keep them updated.
About the child's progress.
Don't give them shock after 4 months.
Exactly, yeah. Keep them updated. Like, tell them about the child's progress and challenges and, like, provide resources for, like, education, for additional support at home, you see. When this open dialogue system happens by the educators and the students, you know, one of the things what the educators can do is they can note down the challenges of the teen. Example, the teen is going to say, might say more openly to the educator than the parents, example. Okay, this can happen. maybe like I'm more free towards my particular teacher than my parents. Example, okay? This is there.
Yeah.
Okay. So now that the educator knows about the challenges of this particular teen, he writes it down and he's going to be like, okay, he's going to engage the parents like in a manner. Of course, he
should really
know.
That really is helpful for the child.
Yeah, which should be helpful. It shouldn't cause him pain. It shouldn't cause him, example, distress.
It should not give
distress.
Adverse
exactly.
effects.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you, brother, for all those insights and helping us. Yeah. Thank you, real listeners, for tuning in. This was all for today's episode. Until another episode, take very good care of yourself. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In every spot of Iran, there is the potential to create energy. Burning fossil fuel in power plants and putting up dams for hydropower plants are not the only ways to create electric energy. Here we are in the desert. Here, every single drop of water is worth the price of gold. So to create energy in this region, one must think of another idea. We are now in the town of Nashdifan. It's a hot, arid, and desert wilderness, close to the border with Afghanistan. But despite the harsh and dry and mundane environment you witness around me, Nashdifan is actually located in one of the world's largest natural wind tunnels. I don't think there is any place as cool as this place I'm standing on right now, in the region or anywhere close by. It's really awesome in here. Right now, I'm inside one of the ancient windmills in Nashdifan. Iranian specialists have carried out extensive research on the windmills of this region. The research conducted on windmills left from the Safavid dynasty resulted in the scientists concluding that this region can be one of the main sites for creating clean and renewable energy from the power of the wind. The windmills, you can see here, are now basically a tourist attraction and not functioning to create energy anymore. Iranians were the very first people in history who harnessed the power of the wind to draw water from wells and crush grains. They created the first windmills around 200 BC. After that, utilizing wind energy was commonplace in Iran, across the country and throughout its history. Building windmills reached its peak in the Safavid dynasty. Yet despite the fact that generating electricity from wind energy goes back to the 1940s and 50s in the US and UK in the modern era, Due to a lack of scientific development, the issue of clean energy was almost non-existent in Iran at that point in time. Cheap oil and the economically dependent mindset had left no room for the development of new forms of clean and renewable energy. It was after the Islamic Revolution of Iran in 1979, and after the decision to reduce oil production to less than 3 million barrels, that the idea of renewable and clean forms of energy that were not dependent on fossil fuel was developed in Iran. Extensive research and studies carried out in this field have shown that Iran has the potential for generating electricity from wind energy in many different regions across the vast country. And different administrations have allocated annual budgets to further develop the wind energy as a form of green and sustainable energy source industry in Iran. The Khaf Natural Wind Tunnel is in fact the largest natural wind tunnel found in the world. Iranian experts have identified this natural wind tunnel based on the experience of ancient civilizations living in this region hundreds of years ago. After this wind farm is completed, the wind turbines here can generate more electricity than what is required in the region. This means there will be even an excess amount of electricity generated from wind power. The wind turbines that generate electricity in this wind farm are all 100% designed and manufactured inside the country. To find out more about the production of the wind turbines, follow me as I go to Tehran, Iran's capital city. There is a workshop in Mapna Company that produces the blades of the wind turbines. This is the final stage of self-sufficiency in the production of 2.5 megawatt wind turbines or wind energy converters in Iran. Now, with this technology and know-how, Iran is ranked among the 10 countries in the world that can produce wind energy converters independently. It's interesting to point out that here neighboring the company that is producing and manufacturing wind energy converters or wind turbines for the production of green energy, there is a fossil fuel power plant that is polluting the air. We hope that in the future, most of the energy required in Iran will be produced through green and renewable forms of energy production or nuclear power plants that have little or no pollution. Hey you, tell the cowboys to take the horses out of their stables and gather in the town square. Today at noon, I want to have a duel with Frankie, or something along that line. But don't be mistaken, this is not the Wild West here. Right now, I'm standing in a field in the east of our beloved country, Iran. This is the Mashhad Shahrud Road, close to the town of Binalud. They have put up these fences as a barrier to prevent snow and blizzards from entering the road. The intense and forceful wind, which blows constantly in this region of our country, is in fact a blessing, and Iranian scientists in this field have been very successful in using the wind to their advantage. Today, Iran can certainly be considered as a developed country in terms of wind energy and the production and manufacturing of wind energy converters. Right now, this 90-meter giant has cast its shadow on me. I'm actually standing next to a wind turbine in the Binalud wind farm. Here they are taking great advantage of the powerful, forceful, and of course, chilly wind that blows in this area all year round.
تولید انرژی های پاک استفاده کنید.
The production of renewable energies in Iran is undoubtedly a very bright one. The vast terrain of Iran, with its four seasons and diversity, provides abundant opportunities for the production of green and sustainable energy. Moving towards the production and consumption of sustainable energy that pollutes the environment less is an inevitable step that must be taken.
Desde el corazón de Asia Occidental, la hora de Irán te sumerge en el mundo persa. Conocerás su cultura y posición en el mundo.
Hola, queridos oyentes, bienvenidos a una nueva edición de La Hora de Irán. Qué alegría acompañarlos una vez más y un saludo muy especial para quienes nos escuchan por primera vez. No se despeguen de la radio que tenemos un programa lleno de sorpresas para todos ustedes. Les recordamos que pueden enviarnos sus comentarios y mensajes a través de nuestro sitio web iranradio.ir. Nos encanta saber de ustedes.